I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. I am back. We were gone last week because, well, our guest had to reschedule, or I had to reschedule. I can't even remember. This week, we have Gregory Hood, who has written for Countercurrents. He's published a book at Countercurrents, Waking Up from the American Dream. And he's most known now for the work he does at American Renaissance. So, Greg, welcome to the stream.
Hey, glad to be here.
So we are going to talk about destroying their democracy. The libs, the left, the Democratic Party are worried that democracy is in peril. And democracy in their mouths just seems to be a brand. It just seems to be the idea that people like them who are basically liberal, ultra-liberal, coastal metropolitan elites have a divine right to rule over the rest of us. And when the wrong kind of people vote, rural people, white people, people in flyover country, that's a threat to democracy. Their democracy is being threatened by our democratic activity. So I would like to talk about the wrong kind of people, you and me and all of our friends out there in Radioland, exercising our democratic rights and destroying their democracy, building up our democracy at the expense of their democracy. And you've had a lot of good thoughts on this. Before we go into this, though, I want to remind everybody out there that unlike platforms, Marxist platforms, right, like Chapo Trap House and things like that, we don't have the patronage of giant banks, just like the Bolsheviks enjoyed massive patronage from Western banks somehow. Chapo Trap House and all these leftists enjoy favorable services from banks. Banks will cash their checks. Banks will process their credit card fees, credit card charges. We can't do that. There are only two places on the planet that will allow you to use a credit card to send money to Countercurrents. One is Entropy. It's across the bottom of the screen, entropystream.live/countercurrents. And the other is Cash App at $Countercurrents. If you want to send a donation to Countercurrents using your credit card, those are the two ways you can do it, because unhappy merchants out there have basically strangled us and cut us off from the global credit card processing industry. If you want to send a question or a comment along with your donation at Entropy, we will definitely read it aloud and discuss it in the course of the stream. Greg Hood is one of our brightest guys. He's one of our most amazingly productive writers. He's got amazing takes on current events and big picture issues. So I'm sure that all of you have questions for him. So get your credit cards out and send your questions in. You can also send your DLive tokens, your diamonds, lemons, ice cream, ninjaginis, ninjets, and so forth, along with questions. And we'll definitely get to those in the course of the stream as well. So let's begin. I guess the most recent chapter in the Democrats' fight to preserve democracy is an old man went to Georgia and yelled at a cloud. So let's begin with the old man in Georgia yelling at clouds and saying they're on the side of Bull Connor or whatever. What's going on there?
I think that the Democrats have realized that not just that they're heading for a historic midterm defeat, but they're heading for that because the Democratic base isn't riled up to support Biden. If you looked at that poll from Quinnipiac that showed President Biden at 33% support, maybe that's an outlier. But according to the data within that poll, he only enjoyed 75% approval among Democrats. You're not going to win an election with that kind of level of support from your own party. So when they went down and did this voting rights push, I think that was a way to try to get the Democratic base, the progressive base, to really get behind Biden, now that they don't have Trump anymore, to scare them into falling into line. But the problem, of course, is that you already had two senators, Democratic senators, saying they're not going to support getting rid of the filibuster. So President Biden gets down there and he makes this voting rights speech where he compares his opponents to segregationists and everything else. This, of course, was very foolish because you can find, because Biden's been in politics practically his whole life, you can find speeches where he's talking about how great some of these old time Democrats were a couple decades ago. And he made this you're with us or you're with the segregationist speech on an issue that he knew he was going to lose. And he was going to lose not because of the Republicans, but because of defections from his own party, at least not willing to throw out the way the Senate operates. And so all it did was just make Republicans, including fairly weak Republicans, feel insulted. And Mitt Romney, and again, if you've lost Mitt Romney, you've lost the cuck vote. Mitt Romney goes out there and says that President Biden is now essentially just as bad as President Trump in the sense of destroying bipartisan cooperation, that there's no reason to deal with him anymore. And he just looks weak. There's also this, and I don't want to speculate too much. I don't actually think he has dementia or something like that. But one of the signs of dementia is just random bursts of rage and screaming and yelling at people when there's no reason to yell at people. And that's a lot of what President Biden's speech came off as. It was just him randomly yelling. And he's been a politician for so long, you wonder if there's any real emotions left. So when he tries to act angry or he tries to act indignant, it comes off as fundamentally insincere. I think the whole country, I mean, he's been in office for a year, and I feel like the whole country has already moved on from him. Would you agree?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that you know, the Dems, the Libs, have just gotten what they want by screaming racist so often. It's the last card they've got here, and so maybe he was just giving it the old college try to see if it would work one more time.
Yeah, the problem is that they're using the word racist for things that you can use racism still. Now, of course, they've moved on to white nationalist. You can use these words to get Republicans to drop to their knees and give you what they, you know, get what they want. But you can't do that with the virus. You can't do that with inflation. You can't do that with supply chain disruptions. You're not going to get more semiconductor chips by screaming racism at a factory. And you're not going to make the virus stop mutating and the vaccines suddenly able to prevent transmission just by screaming racism, conspiracy theory, and white nationalism. So they're using these tactics on things that don't really work. And the problem is that Trump alone getting elected showed that crying racist and white nationalist to people has diminishing returns. Now, we could argue that President Trump was a massive disappointment. Well, I'm not going to argue with it. I think that's an obvious truth, that he was a massive disappointment and he left so much on the table that he could have done, which he didn't. But this isn't really about Trump. This is about Biden and more broadly, the regime. They now use this term, our democracy, always capital O, capital D. But democracy doesn't actually mean people who win elections. So when a Republican wins an election, it becomes a threat to our democracy. When Viktor Orban in Hungary wins an election, he's an authoritarian because he won the election somehow. And now things that are considered democratic include medical orders that force you to take a treatment, whether you like it or not, restrictions on your movement, restrictions on what you're allowed to see or say online. These are all democratic things. Open elections, free speech, personal choice over health issues. Those are actually the authoritarian things now. That's what authoritarianism has begun. And if you look at these measures that these various think tanks set up, they'll say things like, oh, America is falling in the democracy meter, or this country in Eastern Europe is falling in the democracy meter. And that's because they do things like not let unelected judges just tell everybody what to do, because that too apparently is what democracy means. The fundamental premises of democracy, this idea that rational people can look at evidence and make up their own mind and essentially rule themselves, the left has thrown that out the window. They haven't made it explicit yet, but implicit in the idea that the government needs to be controlling quote-unquote misinformation on social media platforms, that only certain people should be allowed to participate in the economy, not forget the marketplace of ideas, just the marketplace, and this idea that if we don't set up the algorithm ever so carefully, the masses will instantly be misled into voting against their own interests and everything else. If you really believe that stuff, then you don't actually believe in democracy. And one is tempted to ask, I wish they would just save us the trouble, scrap the elections, and just have some tech CEOs pick whatever mouthpiece is going to be in charge, because apparently that's what democracy really means.
Yeah, democracy means minority rule by liberal elites, coastal liberal elites.
Right. Real democracy. When we cut away all the stuff, it's obviously a laundered oligarchy. It always has been. But if we talk about democracy in the way I think leftists really feel that it means, like what they actually want, it's ruled by journalists, full stop. What journalists like is policy. What journalists don't like is authoritarian. That's it. And it's no more complicated than that. And the way they get their policies in is...
It's Vox Twitter. It's Vox New York Times.
Well, Vox Blue Chip Twitter, not just any Twitter.
The blue and white checks on Twitter.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've always held to the position of AJAB, which is that journalism as such is not a profession, it's a tactic. And that people who self-identify as journalists, which I think is much more shameful and perverted than identifying as whatever gender you want to make up or whatever else, like that makes more sense and it's less shameful than calling yourself a journalist.
Well, being camcorders is really less shameful than being journalists.
Right? Yeah.
Camcorders don't lie to you as much as journalists.
Right.
Camcorders don't call you up and say, I just want to tell you a story.
The thing that we're slowly coming to terms with, or at least the people who rule us are coming to terms with, is that they've built a world where verbal concepts and the manipulation of language makes people do what they want. And they think, and they've essentially shaped reality in ways that would seem unimaginable 30 years ago. So there are more than two sexes now, and there are as many genders as you want, and there are a million different racial categories and diverse. If we say that there are differences between the races when it comes to socioeconomic status, all of this can be blamed on racism. There can be no other explanation. We can mandate this as truth. And enough people at least will go along with it because you can use force to get people to sign on to this because they don't want to lose their job. They don't want to lose their friends. They don't want to lose their families and whatever else. But now they're trying to apply these things to elements of reality that can't be manipulated as easily, at least via language. So inflation is not going to go down just because the media says that pharmaceutical companies or meat producers or whatever else are hoarding cash or deliberately trying to make prices go up just because they're evil. The supply chains are not going to become unstuck just because Joe Biden thinks that people on Facebook shouldn't be allowed to complain about how he's ruining the economy and everything else. Now this
the underlying thing here is this. For years, Republicans have basically been the adults in the system. And the Democrats have been the children. The children whine and demand things. And they call the Republicans names and say, you don't care. And you're racist. You're evil. If you don't give us what we want. And the Republicans have been very reliable at trying to basically square the Democratic id with objective reality, basically. They perform the ego function of squaring the irrational desires with objective facts. However, they can't deliver everything. It's not within their power to make the virus go away, basically. And therefore, they can't get what they want by manipulating daddy, basically, or manipulating the adults, whom they also hate, and want to disempower. It's a weird system. Basically, they behave like spoiled children or spoiled dogs. I mean, there's something deeply contradictory about a spoiled brat. A spoiled brat has the illusion of being the master and is dominant over another party, and yet at the same time, he's not dominant over reality. He requires this other party to make things work, and sometimes that other party can't make things work, and so the brat is just left there to scream. It's sitting in its own piss and shit and screaming, and the words, the magic words, racism and things like that, won't make it possible for it to get what it wants anymore. And this is especially true if they get what one of the things that they want is to basically eliminate the people who make it possible for them to continue on in the, with their childish demands that don't actually square with reality. Somebody's got to pay the bill for what these people want. And they actually believe that we're the parasites and that they're the ones who create all the value in the world, which is a remarkable delusion. I love some of these blue checks clucking about red state secession and saying, what will they do without us? What will they do without the coastal elites bossing them around and telling them that their children need to take hormone blockers? What will they possibly do? How will they grow wheat without Twitter? How will they grow wheat without the markets? How will they grow wheat without the media, right, and the talking heads? How will they survive without these people? That's how they really think.
The one thing I want to add, the one thing I want to say, and I want to drill this into the head of everybody, I've said it before and I've said it again, is that the central lie of American race relations is that we somehow profit from diversity, that we're somehow exploiting black bodies, that we're somehow getting something from this. The truth is that they need us, we don't need them. And in fact, we would be better off without them. Right now, what we're seeing is perhaps a tiny glimpse of fearful awareness from them that they're recognizing this. I mean, you're seeing all these stories of people moving away from these liberal enclaves to new areas that they'll colonize and ruin. And they'll say, well, where I came from is bad, but where I've come to, we need to work hard to change the politics here. And then when they get pushback saying, no, you don't get to just run away from the mess you made, they start going back to the old script, calling people anti-Semitic, calling people racist, calling people whatever. I mean, the number one thing that we could do that would improve things in this country now, I don't know if we would be able to pass constitutional muster, but if we had some kind of a law where when you move to a new state, you're not allowed to vote in state and local elections until you've been there for at least a decade. Because the number one thing is we need to sort of build a wall around liberals and their pets and force them to live together and say, no, you have to live with the mess that you made. Because the thing is, and this perhaps this separates me from a lot of people on the right, is that obviously I blast Conservative Inc. and I talk about Republican stupidity and how they fail us over and over again. But at the end of the day, I'm still a product of the conservative movement. That's what I came out of. And I like ordinary Republicans. I like hanging out with these people. I like talking to them. If I go to a party meeting or a rally or something like that, even for some stupid local race, I get along with these people. And I think that's broadly true of the entire right-wing coalition. Like, if you put these people in a room, there may be disagreements, there may even be arguments. But if there's no leftist reporter spying on them and telling them what they have to do, everyone's pretty much going to be able to coexist. The leftist coalition, these people cannot be in the same city, let alone the same room. There's nothing that unites black proletarians with George Soros, with hysterical white suburban women who get their brains from late night talk shows and are freaking out because they think Donald Trump is Hitler reincarnated, who think that the vaccine should be imposed on everyone by the military, compared with blacks who think that the vaccine is a CIA plot to kill them all. I mean, you can't have these people operate. The only thing that holds it all together is what Steve Saylor calls the KKK crazy glue, which is they constantly have to hype up this imaginary threat of white nationalists coming to kill them all.
Right.
But what most people are dealing with right now is not white nationalism. It's not the far right. I mean, unless you're going to pretend Ron DeSantis or somebody like that is, you're dealing with objective economic facts like inflation, like the supply chain crisis. You're dealing with the fact that they thought they could pin the virus on Trump, but now Biden's in charge and you had the acting FDA commissioner say, oh, we're all basically going to get it, and there's nothing we can do about it. Well, if that's true, then why are you saying President Trump was committing crimes against humanity for supposedly handling this wrong? And you're also dealing with something that I think is a lot broader, which is the decline of American power relative to the rest of the world. This is why in some ways, I mean, I never thought that Trump won the election that was stolen. I was surprised it was as close as it was. I always thought that the reason he lost was fairly simple, that he lost ground among white rural voters, which Biden was able to appeal to more. And he gained a little bit of ground with minorities, but not enough to compensate for the loss of his core base. But now people are dealing with a United States government that is no longer not just the sole superpower, it's questionable whether it can be a power at all. The fact that Biden is in office while all of these things is happening is pretty good for us. The fact that Biden was the one who presided over the retreat from Afghanistan, and not just the fact of the retreat, but the way in which it was done, which was catastrophic in terms of the people who were killed and the incompetence that it showed. You have Biden facing off with Russia and China, and essentially both of these powers calling his bluff. The fact that a lot of American allies, even including the European Union, are beginning to question whether the United States is capable of meeting its international obligations and is also willing to meet its international obligations. Even something as petty as that submarine deal we cut with Australia, which infuriated France because they were going to sell them submarines or something like that. The American-led, what they call the rules-based international order, is very fragile. And it seems that the arrogance of our policymakers is only increasing, even as their actual power declines. And I think that we're going to see a very forthright challenge to quote-unquote American power. I don't want to call it that because I don't associate myself with the Potomac regime. It's not our government. It's not our country. But we're going to see a challenge to the global American empire's power. And I do not think that the people in Washington, D.C. are capable of meeting that challenge. And what I mean by a direct challenge is something as forthright as Russia going into Ukraine or China moving in the South China Sea or something like that. Because at this point, who will fight for America? You've just told all the white people, the people who are most disposed to be patriotic, that they're the real terrorists and the real threat to the state. And all the people who get the government benefits, you've told them that America was built on racism and sexism and all these sins against their people. So why would they go fight and die for this country?
Yeah, yeah. It's a very bad situation. It's really not playing well to basically have the ruling party's message 24/7 being, we hate white people. White people are the blame for all of our problems. And then, yeah, there'll be a test. Eventually, there'll be a test of this regime, and it's going to discover that it's hollowed itself out, that the people who believe, as you put it, that America owes them are not going to fight and die for it, and the people who have been told that they're terrorists and impediments to progress, some of them sadly will probably fight and die for it, but some of them are waking up, and it's not a sustainable thing. Ultimately, it's not sustainable. And we're seeing now polling data indicating that there's a dramatic sea change in the American mind, especially people on the right. They're radicalizing. They're becoming more populist. They're becoming much more resistant to the manipulation of white guilt and so forth. They're much more receptive to the idea that whites are being attacked as whites and we need to collectivize as whites and fight back. It's a huge constituency. The Republican Party will not officially cater to them, but still the Republicans are going to sweep into power again in the midterm elections based on this backlash against Democratic anti-whiteness. That's a huge part of it. And also the fact that a big part of what was promised to sort of centrist, sort of liberal-leaning, affluent suburban people who didn't like Trump was that the Democrats were the party of public-spiritedness and technocracy. That was their whole shtick about COVID. Getting your vaccine was a sign that you're a good citizen, a public-spirited person. These people who are skeptics are evil. They're moral lepers, and they should be cast out of the body politic. Well, technocracy combined with public spiritedness is crapping out badly with Omicron. I've known a number of people who have gotten Omicron, and the ones who got sickest were the ones who have been vaccinated. I'm getting over Omicron right now. I never was vaccinated, and I wouldn't even call it a cold. I would call it more akin to allergy season. That the only thing that I've noticed is a bit of congestion. But I've known people who have been double or triple vaccinated who have been flat on their backs because of this. So the public-spirited technocracy that the Democrats were presenting themselves as, with the implicit promise that if you just get the jab and go along with us and go along with the hysteria, we'll calm down and we'll let you go back to living your life. They failed in that implicit promise as well. So it's a massive failure of legitimacy for these people. And this is a huge opportunity. Now, if you look at the election maps from 2020, and you look at the county maps, not the state maps, but the county maps, America is a vast red nation with these blue urban, primarily urban tumors of liberalism, primarily on the coast, although you find some of them in the middle of the country. It turns out they're where there are Indian reservations and things like that in places like New Mexico or Montana and so forth. You'll suddenly get a blue tumor popping up. But the vast majority of constituencies in America are red, and some of them went for Trump with landslide margins. And as we know now from the recent races in Virginia, those rural voters are going even further, even more resolutely towards the red. So this seems like an amazing opportunity for our people to reap some benefits from backlash politics and start running for office and getting elected. And I know you've got some thoughts on that, and I'd like to segue into that. Do you think this is a time for people to start thinking about running for local and state and even federal offices, national offices, if they can?
Yes, with a couple caveats. First of all, if you're somebody like me, if you're somebody who has been working explicitly in white identity politics, I would not advise running, simply because you're going to spend all your time fending off that. A lot of people underestimate what it takes to get on the ballot. If you try to do a third party run or start a third party or build a third force, whatever you want to call it, 99% of your time and money is going to be spent collecting signatures just to get on the ballot. And it's just a fact of American politics that a certain number of people are not going to vote for a third party no matter what. The Republican Party could put, I think there was a case in Illinois not that long ago where a neo-Nazi, and by neo-Nazi, I mean a like explicit follower of the NSDAP, somehow got the Republican nomination and was running on like a platform of Holocaust denial or something like that. And he still got, and he was condemned by the party and everyone went crazy and the media had a field day, but he still won a huge chunk of the vote because people walked in there and just voted Republican no matter what. I think if you're going to try to, if there's nothing on you, so to speak, this is a good cycle to try to start your political career. And the thing that needs to be pushed is not so much white identity, but the idea of white equality under the law, which of course is going to be condemned as white supremacy and white nationalism. I mean, explicitly getting rid of affirmative action. And this is another way where we can turn this rhetoric of our democracy, again with the capital letters, against itself. Right now, the idea of anti-white policies is mainstream. Republicans and conservatives will use the words anti-white. That in itself is a huge victory. But it doesn't mean anything unless it actually turns to policy outcomes. And I think the one policy, and I don't think there's even much intellectual opposition to this within Conservatism, Inc., is getting rid of all affirmative action policies. Now, obviously, the big thing that set everything in motion, The Age of Entitlement, that book describes this very well, was the Civil Rights Act. But I think going after that specifically is too much for anything right now. But if you tried to build some momentum behind the idea of scrapping affirmative action and scrapping race-based policies, you might be able to get some more Asian and Hispanic support for that as well. You can still campaign and stay within the respectable Republican fold. And what I think I'm counting on, and what I think we should all be counting on, is the fact that the Democrats and the people who really do believe the propaganda, who really do believe what the television is telling them, they're not going to be able to turn it off. They're not going to be able to dial down the hysteria. It's just going to get more and more insistent that what we're facing now really is the biggest threat that we've ever faced. I believe that Governor DeSantis in Florida, his opponent for the upcoming gubernatorial race, compared him to Hitler when someone said, do you think that's a little extreme? She said no. And I think a lot of people really do believe that kind of thing. And so if you push policies that touch on racial issues, would actually do something good for our people, I don't have any illusions that the Republicans are going to come around and start supporting these things. I also don't have any illusions that the Republican Party can be saved. That the United States can be saved, but that they either can be saved, really. But I do think that even a very mild pushback on these kinds of issues will force the Democrats and the left to go so crazy and go so over the top that it's going to force a greater confrontation. I think those who want change at the deepest level in the United States should be focusing more on provoking the beast to strike back in counterproductive ways rather than trying to operate by essentially organizing the masses, because organizing the masses is going to be very hard to do when we're cut off from most social media and from financial institutions. The best you can do is build a small group of people who will be able to survive what's coming and just watch as Washington, D.C. thrashes around and makes a fool of itself before the entire world. One other thing I want to add is that Samuel Huntington, of course, talked about dividing, and he wasn't alone in this, dividing the world into different civilizations. And that's the way you should examine the different groups. I would suggest that perhaps the best way of looking at the world now is defining the world in terms of dominant media blocks, in terms of where people get their information from. One America News actually was just not renewed by DirecTV. This was portrayed as a great victory for our democracy. Again, corporate censorship is apparently democratic and good now. And if you look at what's really driving people in terms of how they vote, where they behave, where they shop, everything else, it's really what media they consume. And so when we see these things about, there's a conflict in Russia, or there's a conflict in the South China Sea and everything else, we should also be looking at what the other side, maybe not the other side, other countries' dominant media are saying about us. It's interesting that in China, the government has used social media to whip up nationalism and patriotism, and that's putting pressure on American corporations who are, not surprisingly, buckling just as quickly as they buckle to Black Lives Matter. In Russia, there's not much enthusiasm for a war, but everybody believes Putin is right when it comes to the security challenge that NATO membership for Ukraine could pose. So in this country, we really should look at what leftist media is saying and not just laugh at it, but just assume that 80% of the people watching it are only watching it because they believe every word of it. And maybe we kind of outthink ourselves when we say, they're putting forward this narrative because they're trying to be clever and do this, that, or the other thing. I think they really believe what they're saying a lot of times. And I also think that when it comes to the elite's master plan, as particularly shown with the COVID-19 pandemic, they don't really have a master plan. They're just kind of reacting. And I think the idea of competence, the idea of voting for Biden because he's just going to be more competent somehow, I mean, that has clearly gone out the window. And the last nail in that coffin was the FDA commissioner saying we're all going to get COVID, in which case, why bother with any of this?
Yeah.
Why do we even have any of this stuff? Just get rid of it and let her rip, because apparently there's, you know, all we can do is kiss your butt goodbye anyway.
Yeah, so let's look at some questions here. Well, actually, I have a couple questions. First of all, I agree with you that people with a clean public record should be the ones who are going out and running for office. If there's an office in your constituency that's open or that looks...
Yeah, and run as a Republican.
Okay, that was the first question. Run as a Republican, run as a Democrat, what?
Yeah, definitely run as a Republican, because it's not a question of... First of all, there is no Republican Party. There's a label, there's a brand, but there's not a party committed to a central political message the same way as there is in Europe. I mean, in Europe, you have parties that identify with groups of people, and these ties go back for centuries in some cases. Here, what the party stands for can change based on one guy. I mean, I think one of the longest lasting changes that President Trump, ironically, was able to do was break the GOP from being the free trade party. The GOP is no longer the free trade party, and that's reflected even in polls of the base. So if you're trying to seek office and you're trying to win, you're not just trying to, you know, have a message, you should run as a Republican.
Yeah, I mean, they're the ones who are going to benefit from the backlash. So it just makes sense to get on that ticket and not be too autistic about what the Republicans stand for. The Republicans stand for whatever
the candidate stands for. There is no set thing. I mean, you could, in theory, get nominated as a Republican and say, you know, call for socialism or something, and you're still going to get the vast majority of Republican voters who are just going to vote for you anyway. They don't look past the party line. Now, some are going to say, well, what about third parties? What about these new projects that other people are starting? I am not saying that there's not a place for that. I'm also not saying that there's not a place for deliberately running candidates for Republicans to lose because you want to punish them for not being explicitly pro-white, or the idea of having a party that's a vanguardist vehicle just for organizing people and you can use it to do other things. Those are all valid things to do. But if your goal is to take advantage of the current backlash and get into office and try to push specific policies, there's no way to do that other than running as a member of one of the main two parties. Now, some might try to be clever and say, oh, I'm going to try to get the Democratic nomination. Maybe in some locality somewhere that makes more sense. But from where I sit, I don't see it. I think that running as a Republican is probably your best bet, unless you're in some area of the South where they're still voting Democratic just because.
Right. That's an interesting question. The other question is this. Do you run for office on a completely anodyne platform and keep your power level hidden? Or do you go all out and start talking about dismantling the Civil Rights Act, dismantling affirmative action, ending critical race theory in schools and things like that? I think an argument could be made for both, frankly. If you think that you can actually gain power and then do what you want once you've got power by just hiding your power level, go for it. If you want to go out there with guns blazing and just get these issues talked about and not be too concerned about winning, and maybe winning anyway if you're effective enough at it, that's also something you can argue for. What are your thoughts on that?
It really depends on the district. Honestly, and this is the thing. I mean, I know everyone wants me to have some grand theory of what should be done in terms of our approach to the electoral process and everything else. It gets really boring really fast, and it ultimately comes down to breaking down your district and the demographics of the district and how people historically vote in terms of what you can do. If you get the Republican nomination in a district that's D+10, you're not going to win no matter what you do. You could run the perfect campaign, you could do whatever. So you might as well go out guns blazing, because at that point, what you're trying to do is get the Republican mainstream to move further to our positions. Go nuts, talk about scrapping the Civil Rights Act, whatever else. If you want to win, I think a case can be made that now it is acceptable to campaign against anti-white policies. Maybe you call it something different and say that what we want is racial equality under law, which would be just as good in terms of it. I mean, it would have the same effect. It would also, you'd probably have a better chance of winning the Asian and Hispanic vote doing something like that than what some overpaid Republican consultant would tell you. One of the things that's rather depressing, once you've worked in politics for any length of time, is Republican consultants' job is not to win you the election. It's to get your money. So you look at things like, and even when they switch sides, when they say, oh, well, these people are pretending to Republicans the whole time. No, they've always been what they are. Their job is to get your money. When something like the Lincoln Project goes from Republican to Democratic, and people say, well, how, here's what they said 10 years ago. It's like, well, yeah, but that's what they were saying to get the checks then. This is what they're saying to get the checks now. And then you look at, for example, that ill-advised stunt that arguably cost the Democrats the gubernatorial election in Virginia. The new Republican governor of Virginia is being inaugurated as we speak. That's not going to hurt them at all. That's still going to bring them in more money. It was a media stunt. It got them attention. It accomplished its purpose. The fact that they lost the election doesn't matter to them. So if you're saying something like, well, I'm pro-white, but I don't want to necessarily write off the Hispanic vote or the Asian vote or whatever other group vote, the things that Republicans tell you to do, Republican consultants tell you to do to win these people's votes are not actually what they want. So they'll say something like, you should support amnesty because that'll win the Hispanic vote. That's not actually true. If you look at the polls, that's not what they want. No. Same thing with the Asian vote. If you say, oh, well, actually they want like this complicated thing that nobody's ever heard of. Like, no, what they want is their kids not being discriminated against when they apply for elite schools. So you can say these things and have a real chance at winning and be productive and not be a cuck, depending on the district that you're in. Mm-hmm. But again, you need to look at your environment. You need to have some sort of support. You don't need to start off by running for Congress or something like that. You could run for state rep. You could run for any number of seats win and go from there. I think one of the best things that people should be doing right now, I completely disagree with the idea of trying to take back the cities or something like that. I think that one of the progressive complaints about America's electoral system, which is actually true, but I think it's a good thing, is that rural areas are overrepresented. There are areas where people essentially have no opposition or no political representation, I should say, and there's no opposition to who's in charge now. But if you go to some of these areas, you can either work your way in or you can just run in some of these places and get elected or be on a staff and get other people jobs and do things like that. Have no illusions that you can sneak into the GOP and transform it from within. I mean, look what happened to the James Alsup and guys like that. I mean, the minute they get a sniff of anything, they're going to throw you out. But at this point, the base is so fired up that you might be able to run on something and win. And at that point, the party will fall in line behind you. That's exactly what happened with Donald Trump. And we're also not in the same environment that we were in even 2 years ago in terms of what you can say. 2 years ago, you did not have people on Fox News or wherever else saying things were anti-white. Now you do. That's a big change. And so even though we being white advocates have been kind of marginalized when it comes to social media and Twitter and things like that, the message is more popular than ever and is more mainstream than ever. And so we shouldn't underestimate our influence, and you out there shouldn't underestimate what you can potentially do, particularly by seeking power from the periphery, which is in some of these rural districts that are completely unrepresented right now.
I think that's a great idea. Another thing that you alluded to that we should talk more about is, if you're not going to run for office, volunteer or see if you can get on staff with a candidate. That is a way in. Oftentimes, that's where it's staffers who are interacting with people.
Yeah,
one of them can do a lot.
One of the things that a lot of people don't know is that this country is actually run by a bunch of overworked, low-paid 20-year-olds on the Hill, because those are the only people who actually read the legislation. The congressmen and the senators certainly don't. They spend all their time fundraising, and they'll vote however their LAs or legislative aides tell them to vote. So if you can work your way in. But I want to put a very important caveat here. This is if you're starting off. This is if you're it's the same advice I would give to somebody who wants to join the military or something. It's like, if you're going to do it before there's anything on you, before you get involved in any kind of political involvement. Your first political involvement should be getting involved in Republican politics or something like that. If you're already a white advocate, if you're already known as such and talk about these things, with very few exceptions, maybe in a certain district or if you have certain financial backing or wherever you are, maybe you can pull something off. But if you're already known, don't try to parachute into some race and make it all about you, because that's just what the other side wants. You're just going to be made a fool of. The party, the GOP, will instantly throw you under the bus. You can't even complain or be surprised about it. The biggest political sin is looking weak. I mean, that's why Biden is in the situation he's in. It's not because he made some demagogic speech or blundered on this or that thing. It's because he's weak and nobody fears him. And everybody knows he's essentially a lame duck, even though he's only been in for a year. But if you are a white advocate and you say, well, how can I affect the political process? Then there are different things. First of all, what we're doing now, I would argue, is engaging in the political process. But in that case, maybe, again, depending on the district, depending on who represents you now, maybe that's when you start thinking about third parties. Maybe that's when you start thinking about a run that is essentially an attempt to educate a mass base, because running for office is one of the few ways you can still do that. And maybe deliberately trying to make a particularly bad Republican lose. But that's there's nothing in between those two things. I mean, you really do have to be all in or all out. And if there's anything on you, so to speak, I would not advise running for office unless you think you're in a district where that's actually going to help you somehow. And obviously, white advocate covers a lot of ground. It depends what they've got on you and what you've said in the past.
Right. One thing I want to talk about as well is some of our allies, some of my friends. I have I know he's listening to the podcast right now, a Wiley Levantine friend on the West Coast who's on our side. I know some based Punjabis wearing Trump turbans. I know of lots of people in, say, states like Florida with Hispanic surnames who basically agree with the sort of stuff that we're talking about and burn with anger over the system. Well, first of all, they think what's being done to white people is an injustice. And so they listen to our media and agree with a lot of our positions. If there are non-whites out there or off-whites out there who, would not be lumped in with white people, but be able to claim that they're an outsider and a minority who still, they're Asians listening to this stream, who agree with a lot of our talking points, you're in a really good position to get involved in the political process too. Republicans will fall all over themselves to basically usher you to the platform and give you the microphone. You will be the keynote speaker of as many Republican events as they can cram into a calendar. I honestly think that you should be both idealistic and cynical, and run as well. If you want to get in the process and run on ending anti-white discrimination and ending the insane worship of blacks and basically the idea that black people and only black people matter in America, which is basically what this BLM cult and post-BLM, post-Floyd policies are boiling down to, get involved as well. I don't see any reason why you should not get involved. You might think it's very cynical and unprincipled, and I think it's absolutely wonderful if you can make some headway. And if you're battling these sorts of policies, then I think you're an ally as well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with any of that. The only thing I would caution is that we whites have to be willing to take our own side, and we can't rely on somebody else to come save us. Nobody is coming. It's just up to us. But I mean, if you want to be really cynical, frankly, if you're some unemployed black guy listening to this and you don't care about politics one bit, but you're just looking to get a job, look, man, just call yourself a conservative. You'll be a millionaire within 2 years. You can thank me later. Send a check or something. There's no easier racket.
There's no easier grift. Yeah.
Right.
But seriously,
could do stuff. I mean, again, it's not, you don't even need to call it opposing anti-white policies. If you were just running on a grounds of racial equality under the law, I mean, that's what getting rid of affirmative action is.
Yeah.
That would be enough. And that would, if you break it down the numbers, I mean, that would actually have benefit Asians more than it would whites.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it would be great to see that happen as well. And I think it, in anything basically that chips away at the current anti-white paradigm is good, as far as I'm concerned. Any form of agitation that causes this system to tremble is good. And even if it's defeated, and that's the thing that I want to talk about too. If you are in an affluent neighborhood in a corrupt, black-run, crime-ridden city like Buckhead in Atlanta, there are plenty of examples that you can follow to secede from the city and become your own city. This is enormously good. And even if it doesn't work, it's incredibly educational for people. We want to see as much agitation for separation as possible. If it works, that's great. You have better neighborhoods and lower taxes and lower crime and more responsive city governments. And if it is crushed, you've learned something about the way the system works. That is something that white advocates really can't lose. Heads we win, tails they lose. And those are the kinds of propositions that we should be betting on. If we can get things set up in such a way that no matter what the outcome, there's something beneficial to us. I think that that's really a really good use of our political time and resources.
Yeah, all secession movements within the union at this point should be supported. I know there's this whole debate about national divorce and secession from the union and everything else. Look, that's so broad and so many things have to happen before that it's almost not even worth getting into now. But the idea of changing boundaries within the union, the idea of breaking away from cities and everything else, I'm not saying secession is treason or sedition or something like that, but some people are going to call it that. But you can't call redrawing state boundaries treason. You know, it's not the same thing. And it's something that people can grasp much more easily. It's something that's happening right now. It's also something that needs to happen. And increasingly, I think it's going to be something that the GOP is forced to deal with. I mean, here's the secret about the GOP guys. The guys who are in charge, like, they all know. They're not stupid. Well, some of them are stupid, but most of them are not stupid. And they see how people vote. And they understand what this means for the party long term. Now, maybe they can't break out of that idea that, well, this just means we have to work really, really hard to get non-whites to vote for us. I think a lot of them understand that that will never happen. That's why they draw, and the proof is the way they draw congressional boundaries when they get a chance to gerrymander stuff. It's all about demographics, and they'll say, well, there's no such thing as identity politics, but come election day, Republicans and Democrats and reporters and whatever else, all of them put their projections based on the turnout of different demographic groups. It's just a racial headcount. That's all it is. That's what our democracy really boils down to, media manipulation and racial headcounts.
Right.
And the idea of setting up a new state, particularly if DC is going to be brought in as a state, particularly if even Puerto Rico, some are talking about breaking up existing states. This is not extreme. I mean, this is what the GOP is going to have to do just out of sheer self-interest. And while a lot of them may be dumb, and while a lot of them care nothing about what happens to the country after they die or care nothing about their kids or certainly care nothing about us. They do care about staying in office, and they do care about having a certain amount of power in D.C. It's no fun being in the House when you don't have the majority. You really have nothing to do. So I think you will start to see more momentum behind these sorts of things. And this is something that can be done, especially at the county level too, which is why I would urge people to look at getting in the office at the county level or the state level, state legislature, I mean, because it's much more approachable. And in some of these areas, sometimes you don't even have a candidate. I mean, just by putting yourself forward, you're going to win. So that's something you can do right now.
Yeah. There's a lot of screeching about our democracy directed at white people in rural areas who lean Republican becoming election officials, getting involved on the local level with things that affect how elections are actually run. And of course, we know why they're doing this, because the Democratic Party is the party of electoral fraud, and they don't want any oversight. They really don't want oversight over the shenanigans that go on in certain major metropolitan areas. When 80% white Seattle votes like darkest Detroit, you know there's something fishy going on in Seattle. And we know the stories of cars with their trunks filled with stolen ballots and things like that in King County. That really does happen. So getting involved with the actual process of administering elections to try and get some oversight and fairness there, especially where the left basically has a lock on electoral theft, I think is an important thing. I do think we had a stolen election last time. I think there were so many strange middle of the night anomalies that the best explanation for what happened is there was a systematic theft going on. And we would like to make sure that that's less likely to happen. And that's another way that people can get involved. And people are getting involved. And it's really upsetting, because democracy means basically, whether you vote for it or not, being ruled by the Democratic Party. That's what the establishment wants. So let's take a quick look at some of the questions that have come in at DLive, first of all. I want to thank some people here. Horatius 14 has donated a diamond. Alaska Chaga 1 Ninjagini, thank you. The Thin Red Line has donated an ice cream. Slog 15 Lemons Pandit has donated 1 diamond. Deconstruct 1 Ninjagini, very generous. Ninja Warrior 9 ice cream. Deconstruct another Ninjagini. Happy January, thank you very much. And Trucker Chris has donated 1 diamond. I very much appreciate that. Over at Entropy, let's just run through a few of these quickly. Nils has sent $50. Here is the donation for the month of January, given in the name of the great god Ingwe Fryer. In addition, I have a lighthearted question to be answered if there are no better ones to be found. If the panel were to give up their lives as political activists and move into the wild to live as animals, which animals would you choose? Okay. That's a good question. That's an entertaining question. I'm going to ask.
I think the answer is pretty obvious for me.
Okay, you'd live as a wolf.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's. I don't even think you need to ask that question to me. So.
Okay. Yeah, he'd live as a wolf. Honestly, yeah, I think I would probably go for a wolf or a fox or something like that. Certainly, I'd certainly be one of the carnivores. Put it that way, a carnivore a canine carnivore of some sort or another is definitely appealing to me. I'm a dog person. What can I say? So Stephen writes in, says thanks, and says sends five US dollars. Thank you very much. Mender sends $3. Thank you. Scott has sent $20. Just as middle and upper middle class whites might see table manners as a more dignified way of consuming a meal than the way they are consumed by, quote, trailer trash, pro-white attitudes are associated with prison gangs and the KKK. Spouting CRT jargon as a form of intra-racism, proving you're better than lower class whites. There's really a lot of truth to that.
That's absolutely right. And that's why ultimately, fundamentally, this is a media battle.
Look, and what, it's what really a battle now, between white people. ultimately, yeah, with black people as pawns and as fetishes and as symbols. But it's a battle between different tribes of whites. Go ahead.
Well, what it is in terms of forgetting even race and everything else, if we take a step back, like what it is at the broadest level, where the people who are in charge now, the managerial elite, when we talk about what is it that they actually have, how are they able to manage social, manipulate social relations? It's a battle to control ideas about reality through mass media. And this is something that has only intensified as social media has taken over our lives, as everybody is glued to their cell phones. And now with the metaverse, this idea of being online essentially forever, and essentially you're no longer a creature just of the physical world. It's sort of a union of your online personality and the physical world is what the big brains think we're moving toward. The problem that they're facing, as I said, is that there are certain things that you can't just manipulate with language. You can cover things up, which is why the number of cases of COVID is suddenly going to be vanished. They're going to start making the distinctions of people who died from COVID as opposed to with COVID. These are all things that they would be claiming is the Fourth Reich if Donald Trump was still in charge. There are limits to what they can do, but there are very few limits once you're trapped inside the system. If you're outside the system, which is why foreign media is often much more informative about what's happening in this country than, quote unquote, our media, you get a better perspective. The biggest thing right now, the biggest difference between people who I consider to be on our side and people not on our side, it's not even so much about race. It's just, do you seek clout within the existing regime media, or do you consider yourself an opponent of it? Are you for the media or are you against the media? Because really, what I would love to see in a presidential debate is, and Trump even said this in one of the debates, that I'm not really running against the other candidate because there is no other candidate. You're running against the media because the candidate's mouth is just going to say whatever the reporters tell him to say. I said this at AMRAN, and I was joking, but not by much. I mean, Joe Biden would have been the most right-wing guest at an AMRAN conference if you just look at some of the stuff he was saying a few decades ago. And the idea that you can trust anybody on our side if the media supports them, that is, I mean, that's kind of like the sign of contradiction that shows somebody is at least over the target. Like, you have to welcome the hatred of the media. And this is just me. Some might disagree with me. I've always thought the best way to handle regime media is just ignore them entirely, because you're trying to build, before we can be free politically, before we can be free spiritually and everything else, we just need to be free of their influence entirely. You need to just kind of turn away from them, step outside this universe that they've created for you, and start living in the real world and in the world that you're shaping and that you and your friends are building from the ground up, not something that's being pushed on you from the top down.
So, yeah, and we're seeing a massive collapse in regime media.
That may be why they want Trump back. That may be why they want Trump back. I mean, this can't be right, and maybe I'm misremembering this, but I think I saw something. Again, this can't be right. Maybe it was just for one show, but it was something like CNN's ratings have fallen by like 90% or something like that.
Yeah, I was seeing that the other day. Yeah.
I didn't click through. I did what I always yell at people for not doing, which is just reading the headlines. But I got to break down the specific things. That has to be exaggerated at some level. But they don't have the big brother that they can use. In 1984, Big Brother is the target of love. They don't have that equivalent as like a negative target. They don't have the Goldstein now that Trump is gone. And they keep trying to sub things in like DeSantis or the virus or Putin or something. And none of it seems to be working. Maybe as a last gasp, they really will try to go to war with Russia and just try to do a rally around the flag effect. But this is where we also get some dangers, because if the Republicans take over the House, they're probably going to be more militaristic and more anti-Russian even than the Democrats are. But one of the things why they might not do that is because they have the Lords of Lies, the people who run the show here, they have near infinite power because they control the conceptual system that we're all operating inside of through the control of the mass media. But if that's forced to an external test, such as war with a different country, all the verbal manipulations and all the games they play and all the deplatforming, none of that matters. At some level, people actually have to fight. And it's on a smaller scale, it's what you're seeing with the virus and the economy. Like, the ships are either able to get to the port or they're not. You can call the ship racist. You can say that Republican misinformation is the reason why these things aren't working. You can say whatever you want, but like, the shelves at the grocery store are empty. And at the end of the day, Biden's the guy in the White House. And you can come up with whatever complicated theory you want, but the buck stops with him.
Absolutely, absolutely. I fear that they are insane enough to start a war.
I mean, Putin. If you look at Vladimir Putin and what the Russian government did with Kazakhstan, and then also earlier with Belarus, they know, the Russian government knows, that these color revolutions, the combination of American intelligence with NGOs that more or less operate as arms of American intelligence, and creating internal dissent as the justification for external pressure on a government, the Russians see that's the playbook. A lot of people in the United States among the Republican Party also see this as the playbook. Some would argue that BLM was a kind of color revolution waged against our own country, waged against the incumbent president. And I don't want to come off like a crazy person talking about intelligence agencies and whatever else. I think a lot of it is just private entities that might as well operate as governments in terms of the amount of money they control and the amount of resources they can bring to bear. The Russian government is not going to put arguably the economic prosperity of its people ahead of their own survival. So President Biden has said, has ruled out, and maybe you'd go back on this, but I doubt it, has ruled out American soldiers on the ground in Ukraine if Russia invades. He has instead said that there are going to be ruinous economic sanctions like nothing Russia has ever seen before. But I think a lot of people in Russia, at least at the highest levels, may think that that's going to be coming anyway, because it's very clear at this point that what the end game is for Russia, according to the people who run the show in the United States, is they want regime change. And same thing with China, too. And the people who run these governments, any politician is going to, I mean, this is Burnham, right? This is elite theory. They're always going to put their own survival as the main priority. And so you have this situation now where Putin has said, we are not going to allow Ukraine to enter NATO. And the other side is saying, no, 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 you have no right to say who can and cannot be in NATO. And so there's not really much to talk about. And the question just becomes, when does it become a level of war? Because I could see Putin going into the Eastern territories. I don't think he would drive for Kiev or something like that. But even that, even if they, I don't even think he necessarily wants to do this. I think he'd rather have influence over Ukraine. But let's say they annex those two breakaway republics, one of which I've actually been to. Maybe that would be considered as a declaration of war by the United States, or at least by Ukraine. Maybe they would call that the false flag that is being used to justify everything. I find it incredible that today the federal government is saying, be careful of a false flag, everyone. Russia is about to launch a false flag that will justify their invasion. Whereas a week ago, a false flag was a conspiracy. Just using the words false flag meant you were a right-wing extremist who believed in crazy conspiracy theories and were dangerous and need to be kept away from the internet and everything else. Now our own government is telling us about false flags.
Yeah, I think that if the United States got into a serious war with a serious country, and we're not a serious country anymore, We have a military that's basically treated, treated now as basically a giant social engineering op, as sort of a playground for transsexuals and lesbians to find themselves and realize themselves. It's not really a serious military anymore. And if it has to be tested, I think it's going to fall apart. And this is
I wouldn't underestimate the American military. I still think the American military is the best in the world. And I still think you could, like, a Russian invasion of Ukraine could be fought back. But the real danger for America is that the American military has no bench.
Right.
The special forces, the weapon systems, the Navy, like the people who are the tip of the spear are still better than everybody else. I don't think if you break down just how unbelievably powerful this country is. And I guess that was one of the things we were hoping for with Trump, is that America could be saved and use that power for good things as opposed to destructive things. American power should not be underestimated, but there are certain things that the American society is no longer capable of. We are no longer capable of having conscription. The government just couldn't do conscription. You couldn't do a draft. Right. Forget it. You couldn't handle any kind of whole of society effort, like telling people to grow victory gardens or make any kind of sacrifice. You just couldn't do it. And the people who they would get the most resistance from are the people that they've subsidized the most.
Right.
And while the American military is still the greatest in the world, not only do I not think that the American military could survive a conventional military defeat, I don't think the American regime could survive a conventional military defeat. I think if you saw something even akin to an American, and I'm not saying this as like, oh, he's saying it's a bad thing, but it's really a good thing. Like, no, I do not want this to happen, because I have friends in the military, I have friends in the Navy, and I don't want my countrymen killed. If the American Navy responded to some challenge in the South China Sea and you saw something akin to a carrier go down with all hands lost, I think the whole government would collapse. I think the country would not be psychologically capable of such a thing, because we're not capable of bearing sacrifice. There is no longer any common good. There is no longer any conception of what the nation is. That transgender flag that they came up with 2 years ago and changed every other week as new groups are created, that is far more sacred to the people who run this country than the Stars and Stripes, which, if anything, is almost like the Confederate flag at this point. Now, I think if there's a one-on-one showdown between the Western Alliance, you know, NATO, whatever else, the Atlantic Council versus Russia, the former is going to win. But they have done, and this is something that the American military has done war games on again and again and again, if there's a conventional battle between Russia and China and the United States loses continuously. And they found this over and over again. So I would not be surprised. If you did see a move into Ukraine, I wouldn't be surprised to also see a move by China, because I don't think the U.S. could handle both things at once. I think that was the real reason why they pulled the plug on Afghanistan, is that those in charge realized, hey, we really need to get serious about this, and we can't be wasting our time and money and men screwing around in Afghanistan trying to teach these people feminism or whatever else.
Well, but it seems like a very bad deal, because we lost a major military base that borders both. Well, it's close to Russia and China. I think it actually has a border with China. It extends China's influence in the world by getting out of Afghanistan. I think China was the big winner. So I found that whole thing quite bizarre, frankly. What were they getting out of abandoning Afghanistan entirely and ignominiously like that?
The big question is, how much did people believe their own intelligence? Keep in mind, and this is when President Biden's fall in the polls really began, with the defeat in Afghanistan. You had him saying on the record, the government is not going to collapse 5 seconds after we get out of there. You had this press secretary come out and say that. You had military people come out and say that. Then you had these intelligence reports, which I guess were leaked, saying, oh, well, actually, the government's going to fall apart within like 6 months. It's going to fall apart much faster than they're saying. But it fell apart within like 24 hours. I mean, it was basically instantaneous. And so there's no way they made that decision thinking that it would happen that fast, which suggests that we're in a Vietnam-type situation where people who are saying bad news are just being ignored by the people who are making the decisions. And so whatever they thought they were getting out of that, whatever benefits or, you know, costs they thought they were going to cut by pulling out of Afghanistan had nothing to do with what actually happened. And that, again, goes to the core critique of Biden. I mean, again, I think a lot of people voted for Biden because he was supposed to be the competent one. He was the adult. He was experienced. He was going to be the one who could cut deals on the Hill. He was going to be the one to shut down the virus, not the economy. He was going to be the one to make international powers take us seriously again. And none of those things are true. Trump was better at cutting deals than Biden has been. Biden can't even cut a deal with his own party. Trump made America more respected than America is today. Whether from a white advocacy perspective, you could argue whether it's actually better or worse in terms of the DC government. But I think it's unquestionably true that the United States government, the United States regime, had more respect from other countries when Trump was in charge than they do now, where we appear something like a laughingstock. Yeah, and again, when it comes to just the bread and butter issues of what Americans can have at their kitchen table and whether they're able to fuel up their car and get the food they need and get the healthcare they need and everything else, whether Trump could do, whether we'd be in the same boat as Biden now, maybe there's nothing that they can do differently. But Biden ran on the idea that Trump was screwing this up.
Yeah.
And that if we just put him in charge, everything would be better. And that is clearly not true. And, the FDA commissioner basically telling the country and the world, we cannot protect you. That everything we've said over the last couple of years was complete nonsense. That has not gotten nearly the amount of press coverage. Trump would be impeached 3, 4, 5 times if his FDA commissioner had said that. They'd be calling it a crime against humanity. You'd have idiot protesters, you know, saying he's got blood on his hands and people would be going nuts. You'd have reporters having neurotic breakdowns on the air, more so. People screaming and crying and going crazy. Here, it's just, well, what are you going to do? But the fact that the key issue that got this man in the White House, if you believe the election was legitimate, was a complete lie. And that they have no plan. And that the information they're getting, even with stuff as serious as War and Peace, is either wrong or being ignored. I don't see, the system can lumber on for a very long time in terms of inertia. I'm not saying that if we just sit back on our hands, we automatically win. But it, if you believe in the American regime and the principles that they've been operating under since 1965 and everything else, it is very hard to say that America's best days are ahead of it. I think you'd have to be completely insane to think that at this point, because right now our so-called elites, it's being revealed that not only do they believe their own nonsense, but not only are they not elite, they're not even average. We're dealing with self-absorbed, stupid people who can't even handle the basic tasks of statesmanship. And the only thing that is saving them is the fact that the USA is just so much more powerful than all the other states out there. But those other states clearly sense weakness, and at some point they're going to act on it.
Yeah. If you hollow out a regime by basically throwing out criteria of competence and just make offices about, you know, checking off diversity and intersectionality boxes and jobs for the boys, things like that, you can go for a very, very long time doing that until there's an actual test. And then you suddenly discover, oh my God, the fire department doesn't know how to put out fires anymore. The military doesn't know how to fight wars. They were just sitting around collecting checks and going through the motions and feathering their own nests. And they're not going to kill or die for this regime. They wouldn't even know how. right? They wouldn't know which end of the gun to point at their enemies. I think we're approaching that. The Afghanistan collapse to me struck me as it's okay. I have a friend in the military who told me a story about what happened when a repair team couldn't account for a single wrench. It was an emergency. Why? Well, if you've got a wrench laying around like on an airfield and it gets sucked into a jet engine, boom, right? So these people are held to extraordinary degrees of accountability, extraordinary measures of accountability for something as simple as tools. And they are checked and double checked. And if you lose a wrench, God forbid you lose a gun, you're going to lose your commission. So how is it that they somehow lost track of what, $80 million or something like that worth of weapons in Afghanistan? It seems almost to be the case that they obviously wanted to do that. They couldn't be that incompetent. If they were that incompetent, we're in big trouble. If they're that incompetent, if in the past,
or maybe we're not in trouble. I mean, that's the other way of looking at it. I mean, look, one of the big reasons President Trump won in 2016 was obviously the Hillary Clinton email server thing. And in the aftermath, the media berated itself for even covering the issue, saying like, oh, well, this was a nothing story. And if we hadn't focused on this, you know, the evil man wouldn't be in the Oval Office, blah, blah, blah. But the point of the story was that if you're a normal person who did what she did, you're going to jail for a very long time. The idea of an elite that's not only stupid, but completely unaccountable, I think really gets at Americans at a core level. And Afghanistan was the perfect example of that, where nobody was held accountable for a cataclysmic failure. And they dragged that idiot general up there who spent his time previously talking about how important it was for people to understand white rage and how they needed to bring intersectionality into the Marine Corps. And somebody asked him, why hasn't he resigned yet? And he said, oh, well, the president hasn't asked for it. And it's like, if you had a shred of honor or integrity or shame, you would instantly resign. How many Marines died because of the way that disgusting retreat was carried out? And yet, I think the very idea that he would be held accountable, or the very idea that anybody in government would be held accountable, I think that strikes them as genuinely bizarre. I mean, if you're a random cop at this point, you have to go out there knowing that everything you've ever said, or anything any of your relatives have ever said on social media, or that you said on patrol, or anything you ever do under the most high stress things, like your whole life could be brought to a screeching halt and you could be thrown in jail for a million years for anything that could happen at any given moment. But if you're in Washington, D.C., wielding huge amounts of money and power, you can screw up on a massive level to the point where it costs lives and millions of dollars and nothing will happen to you. In fact, you might even get promoted.
Yeah, that's truly astonishing. And I think a regime like that, well, you know, China went on for 100 years of humiliations in the 19th century before it finally fell apart. So these hollowed out corrupt regimes can last a very long time. So it's not going to unravel of its own accord. We need to test it. And one of the ways that we can test it is holding, running for office, demanding that it, holding up its own standards and demanding it meet its standards, things like that, getting involved. I think this is a great opportunity for us all. And again, we can't lose from this. If you go out there and you win an election, you've won something and you might be able to make your life a little bit better. If you lose, well, it's educational, especially if the system comes together to exclude you in an obvious way. That's very educational too. We can't lose at this point from people who do this right. I mean, we can certainly lose if people are really goofy. There's no question about it. And I'm sure the regime would love some really goofy candidates out there. I think it'd be entertaining, but still, if you're a plausible candidate, get out there. And I want to give a shout out to my friend Happa Perspective. He's in the chat. Happa, run for office. We will definitely endorse you wherever you are. So let's look at some more questions here. We have more on entropy. Redline has sent $25 and says 14. Thank you very much. Archie has sent $3. Twitter and Twitch have deplatformed people for being anti-white, saying cracker, but I don't want anti-white rhetoric to stop because that means anti-black and anti-Zionist rhetoric must stop too. Yeah, true enough. I mean, you can demand that they be consistent and deplatform Hassan Piker, and that's fine because he's our enemy. I would like free speech online, but when we don't have free speech and our enemies do, and it's in flagrant violation of the platform terms of service, go after them. Absolutely go after them. We want them to suffer as much as possible. We want these people to be silenced. We want these people to suffer the same way that we've suffered. That's how you win. You make your enemies suffer until they stop, right? Flying Dutchman sends in $50. Keep up the good work. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Archie sends $3. I can't seem to get this question. There's a few words here that don't make sense. Basically, the question is Biden making small divisive speeches from writers that are soaked in woke, just as Trump acted for Israel based on his advisors? Is he basically being a sock puppet for his woke advisors? I think that's pretty accurate, actually. Cuban American writes in with $100, very generous. What reforms would you make to the current judicial system? What is your ideal judicial system? Greg, what are your thoughts on that?
That's a big question, but I think the number one thing is that the law and the court system should be as little involved in ordinary people's lives as possible. I would even get to the point where, I mean, maybe we could, the goal would be to get to the point where the idea of lawyers as a profession shouldn't even be necessary. I think that one of the big mistakes that we've made, and this is something that our people, by which I mean, you know, the English-speaking peoples, have screwed up for a long time, is thinking that the common law is better than the civil law. The idea that precedent and tradition could somehow guide us. Now, maybe if we had a single people operating along lines of tradition and widely understood ideas, that could still be workable. But right now, we just have a system where judges essentially create whatever laws they want. And the entire system, and since they seem to be the only force in the government that can actually act, theirs are the things that are carried, their wishes are the ones that are carried out. I think the Constitution arguably failed with Marbury versus Madison. I think that's something that the founders never really, or the framers, I should say, never really anticipated. And ever since then, it's essentially been wrong because they assumed that if the judicial branch asserted a power, that the other branches of government would push back against it because they thought that would be the way people struggle for power, just like under the English system with the English Civil War was, you know, between Parliament and the Crown. But what they didn't anticipate was mass political parties that would sort of operate through the three branches of government. And so the three branches of government don't fight amongst each other. They're battlegrounds in which the two parties fight each other. And so I would say that we have to go back to the beginning where any kind of, some people say, oh, well, we just need to impeach judges because you can do that. But the problem is that if you're a congressman, particularly if you're a Republican congressman, it's always easier to sit back and say, I'm not going to do anything. I'm going to let the courts decide it. One of the things that really stuck with me as a conservative, and I'm not digging into the issue or whatever else, but I worked with a ton of Christians who swore up and down and left and right that gay marriage was the most important issue of all time, and they would be willing to die before acquiescing to this. But then the Supreme Court said it was fine, and instantly all that vanished. All the talk about the will of God and everything else, that all went away. So the idea that politicians or even the populace is going to act against outrageous court decisions, I think, is wrong. So ultimately, I think what you have to do is you have to have a system where civil law replaces common law, where arbitration and private services are always put forward as the first solution before any kind of lawsuit, where the law is comprehensible to the average person, and where idea, if you tried to print the US code, I'm not sure there's like a single library that could contain it at this point. And I think you would actually have to have some sort of a control where if the entire legal code exceeds a certain amount of statutes or exceeds a certain size, you have to mandate that certain other laws are abolished. Because I think it was Cicero who said something along the lines of laws multiply along with corruption. The law should be simple. It should be understandable. Everybody should know it. And it should be enforced with absolute ruthlessness. What we have now is a system that is arbitrary, selective. Nobody knows it. We're all breaking the law 10 times a day without knowing it because the federal statutes are so broad that nobody understands what they're doing. And whether you get caught or whether you become a millionaire is essentially arbitrary. The fact that the income tax laws are as complicated as they are, that in itself is an outrage. Perhaps one of the things, I mean, you always hear this empty rhetoric from Republicans about getting rid of the IRS. Perhaps one of the things people could be running on is simply abolishing some of these branches, some of these regulatory agencies, and saying we're going to substitute this one simple revenue gathering thing as opposed to this complicated series of laws and regulations that anybody with money can get around. And this gets back to one thing. This is, along with our democracy, the rule of law is another one of these phrases that should just be met with sneering contempt. Because first of all, the rule of law ended about, oh, I don't know, maybe 20 million illegal immigrants ago. So don't talk to me about the rule of law, because that's not a thing. And it hasn't been a thing for a very long time. Secondly, whether the law is enforced or not depends on whether you can essentially buy a lawyer who will get you out of whatever you're in. And at this point, we're being told that lawyers who represent white advocates should be disbarred, whether if you have certain political views, you should not be allowed to be a lawyer. And my favorite was when some of the people, again, you know, kind of these hapless boomers who wandered into the Capitol, when they wandered in and there were these outraged stories in the media saying you're paying for their criminal defense, because, of course, all they could get were public defenders. And they were saying that, like, even this is too outrageous, like getting a public defender is too much for you now. So the idea that the law is a shield rather than a sword, which can just be wielded arbitrarily by the guy in power, I think that's something people really need to internalize. And one of the founding myths of America that I think we need to scrap and just say that we're never going to fall for this trick again is that there's no such thing as a nation of laws, not men. It's always a nation of men. It's always got to be a person who holds the sword. It's always got to be a person who enforces power. And in future, under a new system, power should be as transparent as possible. I've argued, it used to be semi-seriously, now I argue it seriously, that so-called authoritarian states are actually freer than what we have now, because at least you know when things are going really wrong, where you're supposed to march.
Right.
Where's the guy that you should overthrow? Where's the palace you can storm? In America, if you say, okay, things are bad, I mean, let's go back, and I preface this by saying I wasn't there, I wasn't in the state, whatever, for anyone listening. But let's go back and January 6th, whatever, let's pretend that it actually was like a coup or something like that. Let's pretend they occupied the Capitol. Let's pretend they occupied the White House or the Supreme Court or something. Then what? Like, what exactly was supposed to happen? I mean, that's not the center of power. That's not where legitimacy comes from in our system. Legitimacy is something that's conjured up by mass media. It's legitimate because reporters say it's legitimate. And so what I would do in terms of the law is I think we're getting to a point now where it's so unwieldy that we'd almost, perhaps the greatest rationale for why, dare I say it, regime change is necessary is simply because it's so unwieldy that the only thing we can do is scrap the whole thing and start over, not just in terms of redrawing the statutes, but starting from a fundamentally different premise, which is that this idea that the judges can interpret the common law and that we can have a nation of law, nation of laws and not men, that both those ideas are completely wrong, have always been wrong, and were arguably the biggest mistakes of the founders.
Okay, let's move on. We've got a few more questions here. Phil has written in with $5. Thanks for the discussion, Greg and Gregory. This has been great. Well, thank you. Romana LX has written in with $5. Great show. Politics here in New York City is a cringe fest. There is a street named after BLM in my neighborhood. You can't avoid it. Max Moon writes in with $10. Affirmative action, a points-based system that subjugates single white males to the bottom of the list for loans, government, and private jobs while elevating other people based on color and or gender. Abolishing this law will create a more level playing field, playing a ground for us and whites in general. This
Let me just jump in real quick here. Every single person running for office, vanguardist approach third party, marching through the streets, waving flags, whatever group or no group or whatever you're going to do, everyone needs to coalesce around this. You know, Occupy Wall Street, they said, what is our one demand? What is our one demand? The one demand has to be all racial discrimination against whites via affirmative action has to stop. Otherwise, until that point, the regime is fundamentally illegitimate. Full stop.
Yeah, yeah.
It's nothing. We are obeying it because there are men with guns saying that we have to do it, and that is the only reason we are obeying it. And every single Republican needs to be put on record saying, why are you not getting rid of affirmative action? And the way you frame it is you just say, we want racial equality under law.
Yeah, because absolutely.
Because there's nobody in the conservative movement who actually supports affirmative action. And I'm just going to go on my record here. I worked for more than a decade, one of those guys. And you can call them whatever names you want. You can call them cucks, you can call them wimps, you can call them corrupt. But I've never actually heard anyone within the conservative movement say affirmative action is good and here's why. So just make them live up to that.
Yeah, yeah.
And the system can't survive that. The left would instantly lose so much of its funding and set asides and everything else. They can't. They would rather let the country break apart than let that go.
Yeah. Absolutely. The other thing that we should say, and this will be our second demand, is basically, look, you talk about our democracy. You talk about the sanctity of elections. Elections are a farce if the people are being replaced by foreigners. If you are bringing in people to replace the populace with new voters who will vote for what the elites want, that makes democracy into a farce. The whole point of voting is to subjugate the elites to the will of the people. If the people can be changed by the elites to suit them, democracy is a farce. Elections are a farce. As long as the borders are open, as long as there is no way of preventing illegal aliens from voting, democracy is a farce. Your democracy is a farce, Democrats. Your democracy is based on replacing the people with servile brown helots who will vote the way the elites want. That's not what democracy is for. Democracy is to subjugate the elites to the will of the people, not to replace the people with people who are more willing to vote for whatever the elites want. That's just a farce. ABC is written in with $5. Thank you very much. At the moment, due to the weakening of the meritocratic principle in science and technology over many decades, the U.S. fell behind Russia and China related to hypersonic missile technology. That's a first since 1945. What will happen in 10 or 20 years? Well, if there's more of the same, yeah, we're going to have the gayest missiles possible. The tranniest missiles possible. We can paint them with all kinds of rainbow colors and stuff like that, but they're not going to be competitive because that magic doesn't make missiles fly. So it's no way to run a country, and it will go on until we put a stop to it or until the system is tested by a war or some other international crisis and comes crumbling down.
And the other international crisis, because we, you know, look, I don't want to fall into this, you know, kind of blood and fire type rhetoric where it's like, oh, you know, this is what's going to happen, because like, no, it may not go like that. It may just be a long, long thing, and we got a long slog ahead of us. All that said, the most likely international crisis, I mean, look, if Russia goes into Ukraine and the U.S. does something, the U.S. image gets a bloody nose, but the country itself is not going to collapse because there's not going to be U.S. troops engaged. But one thing that really would put the regime on notice is if the dollar was no longer the world's reserve currency, and Russia and China have clearly been moving in that direction for a while, China setting up its own digital currency, state-backed central currency, that is going to change the international payment system in ways that we can't even begin to imagine right now. That's something that's already happening. And that could be it, because people look at the United States and say, well, how are they getting away with all this? And how are they able to pay for all this? The fact is, the debt and the deficit doesn't really matter as long as you've got the world's reserve currency. I mean, we're all essentially running modern monetary theory in real time and can do it. But other countries are not going to go along with this unless they see themselves benefiting from it. Russia and China clearly don't. And it's sort of a race to see if DC can implement regime change in those countries before they figure out a way of replacing the dollar as the world's reserve currency.
Yeah, well, we found that after 2008, we could just print trillions of dollars and it wasn't going to cause inflation. Well, you know, we've now run up how many trillions of dollars in COVID debt, and now we're seeing inflation. So at a certain point, the quantitative theory of money sort of kicks in. And yeah, if you increase the money supply enormously, you're going to see a decline in the value of money. What has prevented that from happening is the fact that people hold U.S. dollars overseas. And they don't spend them, they hold them as a store of value. And when the United States prints money, what they're doing basically is they're taxing the third world. When you get right down to it, they're taxing people in Thailand and China who are holding U.S. dollars as a store of value because they're making those dollars less valuable. And the only reason why we haven't seen massive inflation after the 2008 crisis is that these people didn't shake them out of their mattress and start chasing goods and services with them. Now there are people chasing goods and services with trillions of dollars in fiat currency that's been printed and put out during the COVID crisis, and we're seeing massive inflation. So eventually economic reality will kick in. And we've been somewhat protected from this by the fact that people hoard U.S. dollars as a form of value. But if the values, if we start getting actual inflation, that means the value of those dollars is declining. And if it goes above a certain point, these people in the third world who are holding on to stores of, you know, dollars are going to say, okay, we're going to have to trade these in for something else, Bitcoin, gold, whatever. And then we might see hyperinflation. That is perfectly possible.
I think it'll be that Chinese digital currency. I think this is going to sound completely insane, but this is actually how it works. And when I read this, it kind of blew my mind. When you were saying that they hoard dollars, what Greg means this literally. I mean, you actually have to like fly a plane holding dollars, and they have to put it somewhere. It sounds incredibly primitive, but this is how it works. And there were actually cases early in the pandemic where people were afraid that the dollars had been contaminated somehow, and they had to let it sit there on the runway or whatever else. And I think that state-backed digital currencies are going to be the way forward because, one, it's just more convenient, and it's also going to be perceived to be more reliable. Now, the question is also that China's economy, a lot of people think, is also based on a lot of smoke and mirrors. The question is that, you know, currencies are fundamentally about faith. That's what fiat really is all about. And I think if you get up to a point where everybody's state-backed, state-controlled, central-backed currencies are of questionable credibility, the only way that's going to get decided is in an international confrontation, be that economic, military, or both. I think that in our case, we might actually get one of those few moments in history where you can actually point to an external change and be like, yeah, this is the part where it all went to hell. And that's probably when they get rid of Andrew Jackson on the 20 and replace him with Harriet Tubman or something, because that'll probably hit about the point where the dollar stops being worth much of anything.
I think they should put Robert Mugabe on the $20 trillion bill. I think that would
anti-colonial be... anti-colonial's hero.
It's, yeah, exactly.
Fitting, yeah. It's what, yeah, it's what America is. And yeah. And frankly, America and Britain bear more responsibility for putting him in charge than anybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have a question from George. George wants to know what we think of Patriot Front. What do you think of Patriot Front?
I don't think they're feds. I think that I've seen no evidence that they're feds. And the idea that people are doing marches and everything else, I think if you think that's the best way forward, I'm not going to stop you. I'm not in it. As far as I know, I don't know anybody in it, although I'm not sure that's the type of group where they go around advertising their membership. I'm not going to say anything against them. I would say that given the current hysteria with federal law enforcement, being in a group, any group could potentially get you roped into stuff that you didn't do because you get tarred with, you know, what other people do and guilty by association. But I'm in, you know, I work for groups and I can't really say that I'm an example of not doing that. So I wish them well. And if they want to do their thing, I hope they meet with success and hope they stay safe and don't get roped into some crazy law enforcement scheme. I would say that even though I don't think that it's a honeypot or something like that, I think with almost a group of almost any size, you have to be a little suspicious that maybe one or, you know, a few members of the group are maybe talking to federal law enforcement. But frankly, that's probably true of just about anything. I think that if there ever does come a day where it all falls apart and we're ever actually able to crack open the federal archives along with the Ark of the Covenant, we'll find that as many people were informing as the East Germans found after the collapse of the regime there, when they found, I think, like 1 out of 10 people was a Stasi informant, something like that. So are there people probably who are informers in the group? Yeah, maybe, but that's probably true of every other group that you're involved in too. So just don't break the law. And I mean, this idea that we have to kind of pick sides or take this approach or that approach or whatever else, I think the way forward is going to be a lot of different approaches, different leaders, some of which are mutually contradictory, and there's not necessarily a correct answer because so much depends on circumstance. Depending on how things play out, one strategy could look ingenious and another strategy could look like a complete waste of time. I think a lot of people, I mean, everybody was united behind Donald Trump in 2016, and now you can make a serious case that perhaps him losing that election would have been better off in the long term. I don't necessarily agree with that, but some people can make that argument. So I'm not going to impose judgment on a group because they're doing something a little different than me, because is it effective or not? Frankly, it's too early to tell. I don't know yet.
I basically agree with you. I don't think there's any evidence that they're feds. And I think the people who are pushing that thesis are owning themselves. And
the thing is, you can say something about everybody. Like, if you really want to go after anybody in any group, any speaker, any writer, anything, you can always find something to criticize them on, or somebody they've been associated with, or they did this or that, divide and conquer. I mean, it is, our opponents very obviously say this is what they intend to do sometimes on forums and stuff like that. So put it this way. I mean, if you're some guy making six figures and you got a wife and kids, like, no, I would not advise you join Patriot Front, because you're opening up to things. You're opening yourself up to vulnerabilities that you don't need to be confronting. And there's more good that you can do doing other stuff, even if that's just donating or writing or working to give people jobs or whatever else. But if you believe in what they're saying, and if you feel like this is what I'm going to be, I'm a dissident with nothing to lose. I'm going to live my life in such a way where it's almost a external politics is almost secondary to an internal struggle or a spiritual struggle. If that's what you feel you're going to do, I'm not going to stop you. And I'm also not going to condemn the group. And perhaps I'm one of those old fashioned guys, but I fundamentally do not believe in attacking. I believe in no enemies to the right. And I don't care what somebody throws in my face until the left starts denouncing their own guys. I'm not going to denounce anybody more extreme than me.
My feeling is that it's important.
Not that I'm saying they're more extreme than me.
Clarify
that.
I think it's important that we have people trying new things, as you said. I also think it's important that groups like this, they're engaged in propaganda of the deed. I look at what they're doing as a form of propaganda. I think that they are doing propaganda in the way that the identitarians in Europe are doing. They have small vetted groups with a good discipline and a uniform message that they get out. And I think it's important to try these things because it can work. It can help. I think it's light years away from something like Unite the Right, which was not vetted and there was not a uniform message and it was just asking for trouble. These Patriot Front events are less liable, I think, to devolve into something like Unite the Right. But let's just ask, what's the worst case scenario? What's the best case scenario? The best case scenario is that they look cool and that the liberal press for 24 hours and the blue and white checks on Twitter do the melting, shrieking Wojak faces and make fun of them and say they're not fat, they must be feds, and so on and so forth. And then it's over. The worst case scenario is that somebody leaving the thing runs over some protester or some bystander, and we're going to be hearing about that for all eternity. There will be bronze statues of this person, and people will piously intone their name constantly. There will be federal suits and civil rights suits and criminal suits and civil suits that will go on for years. And it could also be used as a source for even more an excuse for even more deplatforming, more repression.
Could be done to anybody. I mean, if you had somebody leaving, I don't know, American Renaissance Conference, like protesters block the road, guy tries to get around him, bumps into someone and, oh, this happened. I mean, so yeah, a lot of bad things could happen. Look, if you're in a group of any kind, and maybe this is an argument for not being in a group at all, and this is something you need to think about. If you're in a group of any kind, and I'm obviously in one, you are vulnerable to what other people do. And you can say, oh, well, these guys are trusted or vetted or whatever else, but you never quite know what other people are capable of, particularly in the future. I mean, you're not just saying that you're held accountable for what other people do now. You're held accountable for what somebody you may not even know anymore does 2 years from now. And that's a lot of vulnerability to bring on yourself in the current environment. That said, I also just think that we're in a position now where if they want to get you, they're going to get you. And I think that a lot of the fire, if I had to pick, like who they just, the DOJ just started this domestic terrorism unit, and obviously they're going to be looking for stuff and everything else. I mean, I think that the groups that are the most vulnerable in terms of if you get casually involved in them are actually the groups that until 3 years ago we would consider to be the most ideologically mainstream, which are things like Oath Keepers and, various groups that call themselves militias and stuff like that. Like, I'm not in any of those, but lots of Republican county chairs and people like that are. They're going after some state rep for saying that he's in a group for being in the Sons of Confederate Veterans, which is something that President Biden was praising not that long ago. So in terms of like where law enforcement is focusing its fire, I think it's everything surrounding January 6th and everything surrounding this idea of guns and militias and things like that. I think that's where you really got to have a pay a lot more attention and be a lot more cautious. Once somebody starts bringing the guns out and talking about training and stuff like that, then maybe it's time to take a step back and say, wait a minute, what's really going on here? One thing I would say, and this maybe our European friends may disagree with me on this, is that sometimes I wonder if the Second Amendment is kind of a crutch for us, because you get a lot of chest beating and it's like, well, we have our guns and they're not going to do this. And it's like, okay, but you know, you don't actually want to use the guns for anything. And if you pop up and say, hey, let's do this, people are going to accurately accuse you of either being insane or being a Fed. So Right. What good are they?
Yeah.
I mean, other than like somebody busting into my house and I don't know, other than like target shooting for fun, but there are lots of things I can do for fun. Or if somebody bursts into my house, I'll grab my shotgun, but that doesn't seem very likely. But other than that, what am I going to use this for? So,
right. One thing you said years ago that I thought was very profound about the gun rights people is that the only thing these people will actually get their guns out for is if somebody comes to take their guns away. They are not actually going to get their guns out to protect freedom of speech or habeas corpus or anything like that. And so in a way, they don't really matter. And if the left were just disciplined rather than crazy, they would leave the gun people alone, because the only thing that's going to get these people up in arms literally is trying to take their guns. So you can take everything from these people as long as you don't try and take their guns, and they're going to go along with it for the most part.
Yeah, you can put their kids in a school and say, like, you're going to force feed them hormones when they're six, and they'll mumble and go back to watching the NFL. But
yeah,
you come for the gun. I mean, like, that's the one thing that if you said what would actually cause the country to disintegrate would be as if a president said police need to go around and confiscate everybody's guns. I mean, we'd have a flaming wasteland within 5 minutes, but also that's not going to happen.
Yeah. So Aaron writes in with $20, great live stream as usual. Thank you. And Flying Dutchman writes in with $25, arguably the country our founders created was mortally wounded at Appomattox and killed 100 years later with the Voting Rights Act, Immigration Act, and Civil Rights Act. Patriot Front puts visual pressure on the regime and are part of a comprehensive strategy that for that change we all want. Yeah, I can agree with that. So,
yeah, I mean, I want to make my position clear. I am not criticizing Patriot Front in any way whatsoever. And I also don't see, I think that the idea that they're feds is, you can't just say stuff like that without evidence. And if you say, oh, well, there might be an informer in it, like, okay, but that's not the same thing as being a fed, as like the leaders of the group being feds. And if you want to talk about, oh, there's an informer somewhere, well, guess what? I guarantee you that there's probably an informer in your life somewhere, because basically every group somewhere has got somebody who's trying to do something. I mean,
right.
If you were trying to, that's the irony of the DOJ trying to create this domestic terrorism thing. If you wanted to shut down domestic terrorism in this country, you just shut
arrest
down
the FBI.
Yeah, I know. Like, stop sending out agents to go up to crazy people and encouraging them to do destructive things. I mean, just that's, I mean, can you not see, like, and you kind of wonder about some of the issues, the incidents in the past where something bad happens and it's like, oh yeah, the FBI knew about this guy beforehand. It's like, well, yeah, but maybe you shouldn't have been fueling his fantasies, because then bad things tend to happen.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, we have had a very good conversation here and we are out of time. So I want to thank you very much and ask, what are you working on and where can people follow you? You write primarily over at American Renaissance as Gregory Hood. You also write as James Kirkpatrick. I understand that's not a secret anymore, over at VDare. So how do people follow you? What social media platforms are you still allowed on and so forth?
Greg Hood at Gab, VDare James K, and I've got the James Polk avatar on Twitter, which I'm still on somehow. Right now, I'm primarily writing for VDare and MREN, and doing the VDare book club as far as podcasting goes, and then also Left, Right, and White with Chris Roberts at Amren. Those are both, the latter is weekly, the former is monthly. And as far as what I'm working on a book called Nationalists Without a Nation, Surviving the Post-American Era. That's working title, but I think Nationalists Without a Nation will stick. And My goal is to get it done this year. My goal is actually to have a draft done within a few months. I'll probably have to take a month off or something and just focus on nothing but that. But it's essentially about the position we're in now, where we are American. We can't really think of ourselves as anything other than American. Being white may not be enough as far as a national identity, although I would disagree. I think most people would consider it's not enough. So where does that leave us? And answering that question is what this book is going to be all about.
That's great. So tomorrow, I would like you to come back here and tune in to the Writer's Block. It starts at 1 p.m. Pacific time, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 10 p.m. Central European Time. Our host, Nick Gilvey, will be welcoming the IHR's Mark Weber. They're going to be talking about the Nuremberg paradigm. They're going to be talking about international law, international relations, current events, and of course, your questions. So that will be back here in a little less than a day. So I urge you to tune in. Greg, I want to thank you for coming on the show. You're one of my favorite people. And I want to thank our donors out there. I want to thank our moderators, and I want to thank all of our listeners as well. And we will be back next week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you, Greg. Great honor as always. And especially thank you to all the donors, because you make all this possible.